All right, so I'm Valeria Velasquez. I work for the UC Berkeley Labor Occupational Health Program. Been there about 6 years doing all sorts of health and safety training and education. Today I'm gonna talk about a training we developed called Decoding Green Chemistry for Workers. This was a project of the Western Region Universities Consortium and was supported by a NIEHS Worker Education and Training Program grant. I partnered with Ingrid Zubieta of UCLA Loesch, our sister organization in LA, to develop this training and consulted extensively with Mike Wilson of the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry, Elizabeth Grossman, the author of Chasing Molecules, Poisonous Products, Human Health, and the Promise of Green Chemistry, and Julia Quint, who is the former chief of the Hazard Evaluation System and Information Service, among many others. And no relationships to disclose. So I thought I'd start with our audience. Much like Steve mentioned, the audience that we trained were construction pre-apprentices at the Cypress Mandela Center in Western Oakland. And these were pre-apprentices studying to enter the solar installation industry. They're studying to become electricians, plumbers, carpenters. And UCLA Loesch also conducted this training to a number of different types of workers, including car wash workers, this was done in Spanish, oil refinery workers that were members of the United Steelworkers Union, city workers who were being trained for jobs on the Green Retrofit project in LA, and they included painters, clerks, irrigation workers, grounds workers. So this was a training intended for largely blue-collar type workers. And we had to keep that in mind when we were designing a training on green chemistry, which can sometimes sound a little bit intimidating because it includes the word chemistry in it. So taking that into account, we asked ourselves a few basic questions, which were, how do we teach green chemistry in a way that makes it relevant to people's lives, that makes it a vehicle for advancing the health and safety of workers, and a means of increasing And third, a means of increasing the ability of workers to affect change. This is pretty much the principles that guide all of our health and safety training. So it was a bit of a challenge applying it to green chemistry, but I think we did a pretty good job. So just to give you a basic definition of green chemistry, it's the design of chemical products and processes that reduce or eliminate the use or generation of hazardous substances. So what we decided to do was to start with the hierarchy of controls, where the most protective control is substitution. And we thought that substitution was a good way or a good angle to link this to green chemistry and the health and safety of workers. So often, for workers, it's difficult to replace a toxic substance or product that they're working with a safe, green, and healthy product for a number of reasons. One of which is that they don't have the right kind of hazard exposure information to identify and prioritize chemicals in the workplace. They also don't have the information on safer alternatives, and they often are not involved in the decisions about which substances and processes they're using and products they're using in the workplace. That's usually done by management without much consultation from workers. So often what's seen is that the case is that toxic substances are seen as a mandatory part of the job, and that workers, along with industrial hygienists and other safety professionals, opt to try to reduce rather than prevent exposure. So it doesn't really make substitution a viable option as we'd like it to be. So one of the basic messages that we try to convey in this training is that green chemistry makes substitution viable, it makes it doable and more practical. It really provides the basis upon which workers can raise substitution as an option. And that substitution then protects worker community and environmental health by mitigating chemical hazards at the source, at the point of chemical design, so prevention by design. So, in designing this training, we tried to talk about green chemistry in a way that was anchored in people's lives, in people's real lives, in a way that also acknowledged its current limitations within our system, and introduced practical tools for implementation so that workers had a way to take action as a result of the information they received in this training. So these were the six major sessions or modules of the training that we did. It was an 8-hour training, and in the first session, we started off with a general discussion of sustainability and how chemicals affect worker health in the workplace. In the second session, we did a basic or typical introductory chemical hazard awareness session, and just basically described how chemicals enter the body, routes of entry, and basic sources of information for about chemicals in the workplace, like the MSDS and labels. In the third session, we talked about regulations, and this we went over regulations that have been in place, like the HAZCOM standard, what TSCA does and how it relates to chemicals in the US. This is also where we talked about the existing gaps in regulation and data related to chemical products that workers are using. And we also talked about what's going on in Europe with the REACH law, which has a lot that we can aspire to. We also talked about, in session five, the 12 principles of green chemistry. We didn't go into too much detail. A lot of it's somewhat technical and related to what chemists do in the lab. But we did sort of use it as a chance to talk about the hierarchy of controls and become familiar with the precautionary concepts in green chemistry. And did I skip session four? I think I did. Okay, in session four, we defined what green chemistry is. And at that point, the workers really were kind of getting it, and they were able to define it in their own words. And we compared that to what conventional chemistry is. Skipping ahead to session six, we talked about green chemistry and workers and identified different sources of information, of next steps, ways that workers could stay on top of the issue, and ways to address chemical hazards presently in their workplaces. So I'm going to show you a few examples of the teaching methodology we used in the curriculum. And since all of our trainings are very rooted in adult learning education principles, they're all very participatory and interactive. So we thought it would be a good idea to start with an exercise called Show Me the Chemicals. This is from the Change Coalition presentation they developed called Changing the Chemical Policy Game, where we ask workers to think about what chemicals they come in contact with every day in their average lifetime, in their average life. And this worked really well to sort of highlight the everyday, ubiquitous nature of this issue. So it was a good introductory exercise. We also did a timeline activity in which we highlighted the milestones in chemical production, legislation, and community activism. And it was an interactive activity that we revisited throughout the 8-hour course to sort of build the larger context and illustrate the scope of the problem. We even had the workers take index cards and write down examples of how they had in the past tried to make changes in their own communities or workplaces. So they felt very much a part of this story from the beginning. So also part of the timeline activity, we brainstormed environmental pollution or human health problems that they had heard of. And it happened to be that the BP oil spill happened about 3 days before we did this training. It's very much on the minds of everyone. We also started in session one with a general discussion on sustainability. And as an instructor, I felt like this was kind of a gamble because it seemed a bit idealistic, it seemed a bit touchy-feely, but it actually worked very well in Berkeley, and I heard the same in LA. it was really great to be able to connect green chemistry to broader issues of sustainability, and was excellent. And as you can see in some of the responses, this is from one of the classes in LA. They're very powerful responses from the participants, and this is a list of what we want to see in the future: clean air, no chemical warfare, prevention safety plan for new chemicals, enforcement in small companies, stop disposing chemicals in rivers. So I felt like they really got it. It's really connecting with their interest. Session two, we did the chemical hazard awareness training. And in session three, we talked about the regulations. So this is where we went over the different gaps, the data gap, the safety gap, and the technology gap, and linked it to the regulations that apply, HAZCOM, TSCA, REACH, and the current regulations, the green chemistry initiatives in California that are just taking off. So in session four, we covered what is green chemistry, and as I said before, at this point, after setting the context and sort of outlining the problem, identifying the gaps, we began to define the promise of green chemistry. And for example, we contrasted in really basic terms the differences between conventional chemistry in this slide and green chemistry. So we emphasized as aspects of green chemistry that you make chemical products that do not harm either our health or our environment, try to use industrial processes that reduce or eliminate hazardous chemicals, and design more efficient processes that minimize the production of waste materials. And we also used a case study called Luis's Story. And in this case study, we worked in small groups to analyze this example of what can happen when we fail to include worker health in our efforts to protect the community or use more green strategies. And in this case, the substitution for the original toxic solvent, this was for auto mechanics, was methylene chloride. That was replaced by N-hexane, which was thought to be a safer alternative, but it actually causes nerve damage. And this was one of the activities done in session five to sort of explain the 12 principles of green chemistry. It's developed by Amy Cannon, in which we tried not to focus too much on the details, like I said before, but just to focus on its main concepts, like efficiency, eliminating or reducing the use of hazardous chemicals or materials, producing less waste or no waste in the process, and regularly monitoring the process and evaluating each step using green chemistry principles. And in this activity, participants were given a recipe for lemonade that was totally bogus. It had a lot of extra steps, a lot of unnecessary, inefficient steps, and students very quickly realize this and then are asked to redesign the process or the recipe, keeping in mind green chemistry principles that sort of brief them on. So I think it worked well in LA. We didn't use this one in Berkeley, but from what I've heard. And finally, we ended the training with what can workers do at multiple levels, at work, in the community, at the legislative level, at the economic level, as consumers. And we did this through a brainstorm with the participants, as well as using a resource list. And some things that came up were creating or updating an inventory of chemical substances that they use in the workplace, of going to different organizations or resource organizations that we identified, like LOCH, like LOHP, like the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry. They wanted to find more information on specific chemical products that they identified in their workplace. Also, talking to their coworkers about the subject, about green chemistry, and perhaps hosting a discussion group or training with their health and safety committees via their union locals, if possible. So for future steps, we are thinking of expanding this training, tailoring it to other types of workers. We are collaborating with the Berkeley Center for Green Chemistry to test what they call the PLUM database. It's the Public Library of Materials, which is going to be a reference tool for for everyone to be able to use to identify chemical hazards in the products they're using in their workplaces. It's hopefully going to be very user-friendly, that's the idea. And maybe explore some collaborations with the janitorial unions in the Bay Area to see, to design a project on cleaning products. I'm really interested in talking to you, actually. So, anyways, that's my contact information. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much to our excellent speakers. We do have plenty of time for questions.
I've heard that one of the biggest problems with cleaners is a lot of times that cleaning folks feel like they're not, the products don't work as well as the traditional products. But I wonder from your presentation whether that's just a perception thing, that they don't smell like they think that they should smell, they don't do the shine, they think they should, but in fact they work fine. Yeah, I wonder what your sense is.
Well, I think it's kind of a mix, actually. I think that if they knew how to use them better, and if they had certain tools, better equipment, because what the states have done so far is because of budgets, they've just changed to the green products, but there's other things they could use, microfiber cloths and other things that could help it. In some cases, I think they're not as effective. I do. I think it's a mixed. And we're hoping with our questionnaire that we're doing next is going to we'll be putting out the actual products that are used at each institution in that questionnaire, so we'll get a handle on which ones are more problematic than others. But we'll also have a listing of a satisfaction survey also with the products. So we'll get a handle on which ones are still causing more of a concern. Oops, okay.
Thank you. Claire Moran with the Schools Network, and thank you, Nancy, for the great presentation. Uh-huh. Just a quick note on that. Not all green products are the same, just the way not all conventional products are the same.
Right.
So you really have to figure out which one works for you.
Yeah.
For cleaning jobs, there's a piece that sometimes gets missed. There is another session this afternoon I want to mention. 3306 at 2:30 this afternoon, and 108 at the ground floor of this building, in which we're going to go through some of the state laws and greenwashing or false marketing claims engaged in your cleaning. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that for me?
One of the problems, one of the problems we run into, I work with municipalities and schools, and the custodial staff does a great job of using the green products, but one of the problems is that the staff, the employees of the building, whether it's teachers, whether it's administrative staff, they oftentimes bring in their own cleaning
right.
products.
Well, we have that issue as well, but for the K-12 schools in Connecticut, we just passed a law that's, one of the elements of that law is that they can't bring in cleaners. And so the Department of Health is now designing a fact sheet to get out to the school community. So through your environmental health safety committees in the school is a way to kind of communicate that they shouldn't be bringing those products in. That's been one way, and that's been helpful in our state. It's just emphasizing.
Yes, Don Ellenberger with CPWR, and I'd just like to compliment Steve and Valeria for the great work. Sounds like a great project that you're doing. So, and I have a question for both of you, a couple of questions. On training these pre-apprentices in the program, I wonder how many of the graduates actually go on to get jobs in the building trades? And I'm wondering if they're given a preferential entry at all, how is the fact that they participate in your program? So that's from the point of view from them, and then from the point of view of the building trades, I'm wondering what percentage they make up of the total apprenticeship that's coming in, if you happen to know that.
I can speak to our program in Seattle, and maybe Linda wants to respond about LA and Valeria. The pre-apprenticeship instruction training program in Seattle is very tied into the building trades. Until the economic collapse, their placement was extraordinarily high. It was 80 or 90%, and almost all went into either building trades apprenticeships or, in some cases, city or county trades kinds of jobs. In the last couple of years, it's clearly declined some. And what often happens is people will get parked in a weatherization program until an apprenticeship opens up. So right now, lots of the apprenticeship programs aren't taking applicants. There is preferred entry negotiated, particularly where there are project labor agreements. So they have had preferred entry with Sound Transit and some of the other employers. The other thing, I see Walter's here. We put a lot of people from that program into the laborers. There's a great relationship, and the laborers have also provided 2-week weatherization training for our apprentices. So it's a pretty unusual pre-apprenticeship program. I'm also familiar with youth build programs that are not nearly as well tied in to the union building trades. I don't know if there were other. I think Linda, your program in LA is also preparing people for apprenticeships, but it's a somewhat different track. If you want to mention it.
Well, right now we're taking 40 workers who were city workers who were going to be laid off from their jobs. They are primarily custodians, and the negotiations are happening as we speak, Don, about what positions do they go into and what positions do the building trades, people sitting on the bench basically, go into with these 3 million retrofits, given the fact that a lot of people aren't sitting on the bench right now. And so the idea is people who are being trained will then, some of them will stay in city jobs, some of them may actually go into apprenticeships in the future as well. But it is very challenging right now because the goal of the minority worker training program that's funded by NIHS is to bring unemployed people into these jobs, and instead we are right now training workers who are otherwise going to be laid off instead of bringing new workers in. So we're really hoping that in the next couple of years, LA City unemployment rate is really high. We're really hoping that that turns around.
I'm going to speak from here. Maybe some of the other LOHP people can talk more about how many workers from the Cypress Mandela Center were able to actually be contracted through the building trades. I know that the relationship with the building trades has been very strong and direct for several years. We trained about 60 workers in this particular green chemistry training. I'm not sure how many were able to get jobs directly in the green jobs or green construction related projects. I think there was somewhere around 20 or so. I will say that there was a huge interest from the participants in anything that was related to green construction techniques, which spilled over into green chemistry. So it was. I think that there is something there. It adds to their marketability in some way.
My name is Dorothy Wigmore. I am in this session partly because I have a grant proposal in that I'm crossing my fingers we'll hear about in about a month. But it involves trying to develop practical tools and a program around what I'm calling green chemicals management in Manitoba where I live. And we're working with both the union and the Manitoba government department that's responsible for all the purchasing for the provincial government. And so what I'm trying to do is to develop practical tools that will help joint health and safety committees, purchasing folks, the people who actually decide who gets into what gets into the workplace and people who work with the stuff, help them figure out what have they got that's nasty, what's green, and how do we get that. So I'm looking, aside from the training stuff, some people here know I do fair bit of education when I have work. So I'm looking for a variety of things, but mostly I'm looking for people to play with and people who might be interested in providing guidance or things, documents that, like, that, for example, one of the things we're thinking about doing is taking the green screen clean production action and seeing how to make that a workplace tool rather than something that's used by a bunch of scientists. Mm-hmm. Thinking about how to use, I'm sort of interested in the Plum databases that you mentioned, because mm-hmm. I know about the Ferris database for building materials and how that was sort of developed for people to choose better building materials. So I'm just sort of curious, given what I'm looking for, what any of you might have. And or suggestions that you might have about places I can go, people I should talk to, that kind of thing. some of that I can talk to you after about. I just wanted to comment back to the original topic about the resistance to green chemicals with cleaners. And I know in some work that we've done at LOHP with domestic workers and healthcare workers, and also with janitors, there's resistance because they require so much more scrubbing. Mm-hmm. And I do think that what we found in some groups is that it actually increases musculoskeletal disorders mm-hmm. with using some of these things, mm-hmm. that we had to actually put some attention into ergonomic solutions and really look at you mentioned the new types of cloths, right. new types of techniques, and mm-hmm. scrubbing the table, mm-hmm. new ways of doing it, and I wonder right. if some of the programs that you're doing.
Yeah, no, that has, that, yeah, they are having to repeat work several times, and so that is something that has evolved in our focus groups, and so we'll be asking more questions about that in our exposure questionnaire to get at that. Yeah, and we're going to ask questions about that in our questionnaire as well in the MSDs. Right, that's where the guidance will come in, because the goal is to have a best practice guidance for the state, and that includes the supervisors and the environmental health and safety, the purchasers. It's going to be an evolving. So this is the first 2 years we'll be collecting a lot of information, and then the third and fourth we'll be developing the training and the guidance. Yeah, Tim, go ahead and add.
And it's also education for the clients.
The public, yeah.
That
they need to know. Who's?
My question has to do with, this is really wonderful in terms of the outreach to the workers, but in terms of the thing of like design, like the superintendents, you know, the training and outreach to them, because the compliance when you do the recycling, here on construction, is they don't factor in the extra time and the staffing for that to actually happen safely. And so it just doesn't get done. It's like, oh, we've got all this recycling, just throw it in the dumpster. And it doesn't get done. And the other thing around the cleaning products is you need to soak and then let it stay and do something else and then come back. Well, that's more time. So staffing and time, superintendents, project managers, how are we, to them, to me, they're the ones that really can make this compliance happen and factor in the time and staffing.
Well, I think some of that has to do with the slide I showed and the separation of how things happen. And other people have mentioned prevention through design. And you're raising a point that I alluded to a little bit, that LEED, you know, the credits come for your documentation of what you're planning to do, as opposed to what you actually do. And so some sort of monitoring has to be in place for that. LEED projects tend to be more expensive because there's more planned and programmed to do in these areas. But there should be savings as well. So I agree about getting superintendents involved, getting people involved up front, but everybody in construction knows that it's, you know, time is money, and it's very, very tough to push that through. In a way, if we can use LEED to drive those things and say, if you're going to say you're going to do this and you're going to do it, you have to have the proper staffing to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think the issue of staffing is very important, but the whole issue of really being able to show evidence that this is occurring on those sites. So having programs where you're looking at job hazards analysis of the types of work and being able to demonstrate the time that it takes, the extra illnesses and injuries that occur because they have to do the segregation of the waste, and really looking at how do you incorporate that into your LEED certification. And I know that Don Ellenberger is here, and I know he's been working with several contractors and construction companies. Sanjay Rother, I heard a presentation about him, how they're looking at developing a health and safety rating system in LEED, looking at job hazard analysis and the impact on workers and those type of issues. So those are the types of programs and initiatives that are going to be really important to really look and see if all of these new standards that are being developed and guidelines in the states are really being addressed. So we really have to look at any work that we're doing, that we make that a part of the assessments for these workplaces and make sure that we share that information amongst all of us. Thanks.
Well, I was just going to point out that when we were getting back to the chemical cleaning issue, which years ago in New York, we were working with elevator operators. They would get paid for an 8-hour shift, but when they use solvents, it only took them 6 hours versus when we tried to use water-based, lime-based products, it takes a full 8 and a half hours. So it was no brainer what they were going to use left to their own devices. But what happened was because the lemony smell drove the owners of the buildings to prefer that because the building occupants would see us walking around with respirators when we're using a solvent-based product, and it was frightening their occupants.
Okay.
And then, but the fact that they would see us not needing those respirators and the lemony smell, that forced the contractor and the new workers to accept the water-based product. So.
The jury's off the switch to green products, but they're definitely more difficult to use. Hi, I'm Nita Mashe with Teamsters. We represent Teamsters in various kinds of facilities, schools and hospitals and so forth. And I have a question for Nancy about asthma and the connection between asthma and disinfectants. And was that a factor in bringing about your green cleaning law, in that Connecticut has a health surveillance system? Were you using that?
Well, the disinfectants aren't part of the green cleaning law. They were excluded. So, but it was a concern for us. So that's why we are asking the question in our study, and we're focusing on it. Even though it's really not part of the green cleaning law, we believe that a lot of the health symptoms that we're probably seeing or hearing about are related to the disinfectant use.
Okay, so that takes to the next question for Brandon and you, in that, we are trying to, as you put on your slides, the connection between, green chemicals and less toxic chemical ingredients and, less use of water and energy and so forth. So how are you characterizing that in your study? Are you looking at, symptoms, reported by workers?
That's the next phase. Yes, the next phase is to be looking at each, we're going to have a questionnaire and each institution is going to have, we're going to have a questionnaire in each, and we're going to have the list of products in the questionnaire so that they can rate them for their effectiveness as well as their health related. The study's not an asthma epidemiology study, though, so I have to make that really clear. It's a first step gaining, some descriptive data on use patterns and exposure. So the what? And we're also doing urine monitoring in the second year, but that's looking at phthalate exposure because we'll have different populations. Some are using floor care products with phthalates because they're not Green Seal certified, and some workers are not. And the union has been going out and just kind of asking workers if they're interested in what they think. And so far, 50% of the three institutions that have been kind of just asked are getting cooperation. 50% of the population is willing to do it. So.
Blaine from Toronto, Canada. I'm just wondering, you all talked about the economics of toxic substances, and I'm just wondering, we've done some studies recently, and I'm wondering if there's any similar circumstances here, where we've looked at the cost of not replacing some of the more toxic substances and what we're replacing with green products. So we're kind of looking at the direct and the indirect costs of not taking care of the problem. So for example, a recent study showed us that we believe it's about a $15 to $20 billion problem in lost time injuries or expanded healthcare costs when we don't take care of the hazard in the workplace. So I'm just wondering if we looked at those direct costs of compensation and lost time injuries versus the indirect cost of what it's costing us. training of workers, all that type of thing.
I mean, I haven't looked at it, but I know I've read a couple of reports. One, Mike Wilson, some of the work that they've done was dealing with green chemistry and substitution in the state of California. They looked at the cost-benefit analysis of when you do the substitution and the healthcare costs of those workers in those fields and what's happening. So that's the one report that I know of. I just don't know the name of the report. Mm-hmm.
It was the final report that they were commissioned to do on green chemistry legislation for the state. But it's also very hard, I think, to determine the cost because of the more long-term chronic effects of chemical hazards. So it's probably exponential to what's actually documented is what I've heard.
The disposal costs are maybe a factor as well that you could get a better handle on because of the then health effects.